You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The American dream, the promise that your hard work and sacrifice will eventually lead to at least some sense of financial security, has always been a motivating factor in America. But is that still possible for most of us under current economic conditions? Well, with me now is Peter Gosselin, economics correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, whose new book is called High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families. And I'm very pleased that the book has brought Peter Gosselin to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Now, the cover of the book is a picture of a high wire, but it doesn't show whether there's a safety net or not below.
Well, the argument in the book is that the safety nets that were below us for much of the post-World War II period are either not there anymore or are substantially weakened, have been substantially weakened.
And just this week, Time magazine published a new poll that finds 85% of Americans believe the country's on the wrong track economically. 78% say there is more financial risk to their family's futures. These are very high numbers. So what's going on here?
You know, and what's even more astounding is that if you took those polls, there are similar polls that were taken even during the best times of the last 25, 30 years, during the late 90s boom when we really did enjoy substantial and broadly shared prosperity. And people, even during those periods, were saying they're feeling that so much was going right, but something was moving against them.
Were they onto something, or is it just this kind of American malaise?
No, I think they were really onto something. But we economic journalists and commentators have had a hard time putting our finger on. For years, we spent time looking at jobs. We kept advancing this theory that bad jobs are overrunning good jobs. And then along came the late 1990s, and we produced hundreds of thousands of new jobs and good jobs a month. What I say in the book, what I try to show in the book, is that what happened is that essentially every major strut that holds up working families, and I'm not here talking just about poor families or blue-collar families, but white-collar, college-educated families as well, the struts that hold them up now and have held them up for generations, jobs and benefits and housing and health and college and retirement, even your insurance policies, have all been weakened over the last generation.
Well, one of my producers, Jen Poyant, went out in the street and conducted her own unscientific poll, and she asked people if they've been able to build up any financial security. And here's what 43-year-old Jackie Rivera of Red Hook said.
Somewhat, because there's always a glitch and the system is always taking more than it should be, and it's hard. And your 401k, you can't get as much in. You don't get the grasp. And you look at your 401k, you look at your retirement funds, and you're losing. You're losing money on it. Every area is suffering. And I believe if you invest in this one, that one, everything is losing, and so you in the overall picture loses.
So, what are the largest forces, or what Jackie Rivera called glitches in the system that threaten the financial security of Americans?
I mean, I think what happened is that in the late 70s, the country really was in economic trouble, and we went along with our nation. National leaders, particularly Ronald Reagan, in essentially remaking the economy in a much more free market mold.
I definitely feel like my bachelor's degree is completely.
Oh, yeah, well,
that's another respondent. We'll talk later about that.
Yeah. And in any case, I think that most Americans thought we went sort of a modest distance towards a free market economy, and then the process stopped. We sort of leveled off, and what I try to argue in the book is that I think we didn't level off, that in every one of these areas, the obligation that your employer has towards you, keeping you employed, has weakened. Your employee benefits, which are really the safety net for the vast majority of working Americans, your grasp on them has been substantially weakened and so forth.
So this is different than the other forces that we're used to, which is going back and forth between highs and lows.
This is something that was happening during the good times, have put us in terrible trouble now that we're in a true economic mess, and will keep putting us in trouble even when we get out of this.
Well, when you say an economic mess, there's a disagreement over whether we're in a recession. Is there a specific definition of recession, and are we in one?
I would make a very large bet that within a number of months, the panel that has the officially declares a recession will say we're in one. The rule of thumb definition of a recession is two down quarters of GDP, but that's not what we mean. That's not the technical definition of a recession. And the technical definition of recession is that we have sustained periods of reduced economic activity, reduced employment, and so on and so forth. And we have seen that. And what's striking about the current situation we're in is it's not just the wave action of the real economy, the stuff economy out there, but our financial markets keep clutching, and they have done it again and again and again. And it is the combination of these two things that make this particularly dangerous for the economy as a whole. And then if I'm right about the way American families are living, they arrive at the doorstep of this really ill-prepared to deal with it.
But we have an odd situation where there are some people who say it's not as bad as people like you are suggesting. I know Phil Gramm got in trouble for calling us a nation of whiners, but the president said the economy is better than people are saying. He backtracked a bit after that. Still, it depends on what numbers you look at, doesn't it?
It seems to me that one of the things that Americans need to grasp as they look at the economy from sort of out their front door, which is the way people need to look at the economy, is that the big numbers, the GDP numbers, the employment numbers can be going up, and they can still be at greater risk. The trends I talk about in the book, most of them occurred in a period when the economy doubled in size between 1980 and last year. And yet, I would argue that families are way farther out on the economic limb than they were a generation ago.
How do unemployment rates compare today with, let's say, 25 years ago?
The unemployment rate is a classic example of how a big macroeconomic statistic can get better, and yet you can end up in worse shape. So,
well, you work for the LA Times. We understand that.
I have a vivid – I'm afraid my thesis came to roost on my family in more ways than one, unfortunately. Look, the average unemployment rate at any point in the economy is lower now than it was a generation ago. But and most economists say, oh, that's good news. But the truth is that when you try to figure out what it means for you, it's not just how likely it is you're going to get unemployed, but if you get unemployed, how bad is it going to get? And what has happened is while the average unemployment rate has come down, so your chance of getting unemployed is less, the duration of unemployment, the time you're out if you get laid off, has gone up. And dangers for families are the combination of how frequently bad things happen and how bad they get.
And then we rely on our employers for an awful lot of benefits. So being unemployed for an extended period of time can be quite dangerous.
Very, very dangerous. And as Jackie Rivera, the woman
who
said,
by the way, owns her own house, works as an assistant at a law firm. She's somebody who is making it.
That's right. She's putting together a life. But talking about these 401ks, you know, one of the things that I find most galling as I cover these issues is listening to economists and commentators talk about, well, people have these pots of money. You know, they have the median financial holdings of a householder close to $100,000. Well, okay, $100,000 is not nothing, but that's for your retirement. Oh, and that's for, by the way, if you get laid off. Oh, and, you know, when your kid goes to college and you face that $45,000 decision that you may have to take it for that. And if you, you know, and you have a medical experience. Whew.
And you talk about your wife being diagnosed with cancer. Suddenly, you had to think very strongly about what would have happened if you hadn't had insurance.
And beyond thinking about that, the fact is that there are dangers out there that we all face, even though we think our lives are pretty good, that are simply beyond our ability alone to bear. In the case of my family, we spent about $1,000 on health care last year since the diagnosis. On our behalf, we have good health insurance, thank the Lord, but on our behalf, we'll be spent just on drugs alone this year, $300,000. Now, I could have one hell of a 401k or lots of other pots of money, and I could not fund the treatment of my wife beyond, say, maybe 18 months.
My guest is Peter Goslin, who's national economics correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and a member of the paper's Washington Bureau. He's written a book called High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families, which is published by Basic Books. And you profile a number of families here. How did you go about choosing them?
I started interviewing people five years ago, and it continues to amaze me how generous people are in their willingness to talk about their economic situation, because a lot of these people were talking about really painful experiences. I interviewed hundreds of families, and I picked a dozen or so, 15, who I profile in the book.
The Koss family is one that seems to have interested you a lot.
Yeah. Well, I start with the Kosses because you get to look at two generations. So I interviewed Richard Koss Sr. and his wife, and Richard Koss Sr. worked for most of his work life at a Mack truck plant in Hagerstown, Pennsylvania. And he and his wife had very steady, slowly rising income. I think at their top it was something like $60,000. His son, Rick Koss Jr., did just what you're supposed to do, went to college, went to Duke and got an MBA, went into financial services and did well for a while, but then Mellon Bank, where he was working, ran into trouble. He got laid off through no fault of his own. He was out for a substantially long time. He got into another bank, had a good job, rose in the ranks, got laid off again. And it happened repeatedly. And if you chart the two Kosses' incomes beside each other, one looks like a slow, steady rise to retirement. The other looks like the guy's having a cardiac experience.
But because Koss Sr. Went to work at a time when there seemed to be some kind of an unspoken agreement between employer and employee, you be loyal to me, I'll be loyal to you. That's no longer the case here or elsewhere. We've seen that kind of contract broken in Japan to the shock of the Japanese.
Look, I try to be realistic in this book. We may be in such a globally competitive economy that we may not any longer be able to afford what we may look back on as luxurious safety nets as we did during much of the second half of the 20th century. But loads of people jump from that all the way across the gap to say, well, then no more benefits, no more safety nets. And I think that is the mistake we've made over the last generation.
To some degree, that is a result of fear of something else happening. And we recently did an interview with the man who wrote a book about the deal the General Motors made with its unions. They didn't want to see the federal government getting involved with pensions and health plans. And so they made an offer that worked very well as long as GM was on top. Now is a serious problem for all concerned. And GM is shipping many of its jobs to Canada where it doesn't have to pay for health insurance.
That's right. Look, I try to be realistic. We may not be able to afford as good safety nets as we once afforded, but that doesn't mean we should have no safety nets. It seems to me that this is an issue that we've fobbed off on American working families up and down the income spectrum, and we basically are saying you be the shock absorber for these huge changes in the economy, in the U.S. economy, in the world economy. You be the shock absorbers, and I just think for many of these things, that is not where it but best rests. It may not rest with GM anymore. It may rest with the federal government. It may rest in many different places. But the notion of just sort of saying, man, we're in a different economic world, all bets are off, you take care of it, dear American family, seems like a gross unfairness.
My guest is Peter Goslin, G-O-S-S-E-L-I-N. His book, High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families, published by Basic Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Peter Goslin. His book, High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families, published by Basic Books. We, as I said earlier, we sent one of our producers out to talk to people, and we have another clip here. This one, Deanna Nairns of Brighton Beach. She's heading to grad school because she doesn't think her undergraduate degree is worth much.
I definitely feel like my bachelor's degree is completely obsolete at this point. And it seems like everyone has to take some kind of step further in order to get a better paying job, in order to get stable and on their feet and think about like their future, what's going to happen to themselves, and not end up in debt, serious debt, which seems to be the plight of almost every American at this point.
There was a point, Peter, when we were told that if we didn't graduate from college, we were at a serious disadvantage in the job market. Is it becoming more difficult to find good work after graduating from college now?
Let me say at the outset, I'm for more education versus less. I have twin 11-year-olders, and if they think they're not going to college, they've got another thing coming. But that said, I just don't think post-secondary education, college degree, provides you the kind of economic protective shield that it did a generation ago. And one of the reasons for that is that there is a global doubling of the college-educated workforce, so that the kinds of forces that came to bear on blue-collar, high school-educated steelworkers in the 80s are coming to bear on college-educated, white-collar workers of today.
So many of them now, at least in certain industries, have to spend a fair amount of time interning, or and I wonder whether the internships pay off.
You know, you can sort of look at our economy as a kind of a rifle shot economy. They don't really want you in any full-time in a permanent way until you're sort of all trained up and sort of 34. And they want you out by the time you're 54 and going to have a medical event. And so that it is real. My heart goes to 20-somethings, early 30-somethings who are trying to get an adult job that allows them to put together a life, and also to those who are 55 and are trying to stay gainfully employed in this, particularly this period of time.
So young people wind up with what's being called an unjob.
Unjob.
Have the number of temps, independent contractors and perma-temps and perma-lancers grown over the years?
They have grown. The government statistics on them show that they've grown some, not impressively, but I think that in fact there is a huge pool of them that are not. They don't even sort of understand that they are on temp basis. Last week, the week before, I was at Google and gave a book talk at Google. And afterwards, I said, look, I need to know more about you guys than you need to hear from me. And so I sat down with about a dozen people. And it's just stunning, first, how many don't quite understand, you know, that they're – some of them clearly were employees. Some of them were freelance. But also the depth of doubt they have about – not just that Social Security won't be there for them. They said they pick up their 401k statements, and all of them do save, and they don't believe that money will be there for them either. And essentially the weight of what I'm trying to argue in the book is that you can't live a human life that way.
Well, I spent a fair number of years freelancing, and I found it liberating at the time because I didn't have to worry about any medical expenses. I was young and healthy.
How do you
now? Now I look back at that time and think, was I crazy? But is it the same sort of thing with these people? Do they find it scary? Do they find it liberating?
Look, I wish I had done this as a really organized focus group because I found it really impressive. So there are people ranging from 20s to 40s sitting at this table, a dozen of them, and not one owned a house. That's not so surprising. Housing prices out there have not dropped around Mountain View, California. Not one had gotten married. Not one had kids. When I asked them about essentially what their horizon was, how far ahead they looked, it's only a couple of years. And what troubles me is that how are we going to have a society that maintains itself if people only dare look a couple of years ahead?
You give four examples in the book of people who experience problems with their benefits plans. Are all of their cases connected in some way?
They are, and this is an example of dangers that have come upon working families that there's no reason you should have known. There's all of our employer-provided benefits are covered by one law, the federal benefits law called ERISA, not by state law, not anymore often by union contract, just ERISA. And ERISA was passed to protect employee benefits. So we know that because it says so right in the preamble of the law. But over the last generation, the Supreme Court and an increasingly conservative federal appeals court bench have rendered a series of decisions that have basically flipped ERISA on its head and made it easier for employers, insurance companies, and benefit administrators to deny you benefits or limit them.
So what happened to these people when their plans failed their expectations?
Well, a lot of them. I tell you the story of Ron Burtless, who worked in Burns Harbor, the biggest integrated steel plant in America, who was injured on the job as the company was going bankrupt. And it turns out the company hadn't been paying its workers' comp insurance. So this really the first safety net for workers that the United States created just wasn't there, and he was stuck with near $100,000 worth of health care bills.
Well, his employer had broken the law, hadn't it?
But his employer no longer existed. His employer existed as a bunch of assets that were sold on to yet some other company without the liabilities, including Ron Burtless's, including the workers' comp policy going with it, so that he was left to fight for years to get his coverage. I tell the story of Deborah Potter, who really, it was an American dream story. She and her husband, who's the pastor of the Sunnyside Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Virginia, have five kids, and she realized that she wasn't going to be able to send them to college. So she got herself an insurance license and made herself one of the biggest insurance agents in Virginia and in the country, selling group health and disability policies until she got an MS a few years ago. And the very company whose policies she had been selling would not cover her. And it has taken her 4 years.
Why? They said she had a pre-existing condition?
They said it's not clear that MS was the diagnosis. Maybe it was something else, chronic fatigue syndrome, and so maybe that isn't covered. And in any case, they'd have to look more closely at the doctor's records. And if you look at these cases, you'll see how insurance company claims departments pick and choose the information they use. And so they denied her. And this, you understand, is somebody who's an insider in the insurance industry. And it took her 4 years, the hiring of a lawyer, and modestly a Los Angeles Times reporter writing a very large story on the subject, to get the company to agree to cover her, during which time she had to pull at least one kid from college because they didn't have the money.
And I'm talking to that Los Angeles Times reporter, Peter Gosselin, who has written a book called High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families, published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, these are obviously important issues. What do the two presidential candidates' health care proposals look like?
Well, Senator McCain's proposal looks very much like what President Bush's has been. And I submit that would push us further along the road that I think we're being pushed on along right now, which is towards families on their own bearing immense amounts of risk. Senator McCain wants to give you a series of tax breaks for you to go out and buy insurance in the individual market. And he favors expansion of President Bush's health savings account, which is a sort of 401k dedicated to health savings. And I think that this is a risk that most Americans, maybe there are some, there's some entrepreneurs who are happy to bear this, or some people who, you know, love to take chances, but most Americans simply don't want to bear this and can't afford to bear it if they get hit with a big medical event.
But during the primaries, Paul Krugman of the New York Times was very critical of Barack Obama's health care plan as well. He felt it fell far short of the one that Hillary Clinton was proposing.
That's right. And since Senator Obama has cinched the nomination, he has been remarkably quiet about issues of economic security for Americans. And I says maybe what's happening is he's keeping his powder dry for a really tough fall election. But what worries me is that People are so upset with the current administration and with Republicans that they'll simply shoo Obama into the White House without asking for policies that actually help Americans feel more secure.
One of the big problems is the practice of rescissions in the insurance industry. How does that work?
It's an amazing practice, and one of the reasons why your listeners should be very reluctant to be pushed into buying their own insurance in the individual market. California has become unfortunately, a kind of laboratory for this. So I tell the story of a woman who bought an individual policy after she'd been covered by a group policy and then left her employer, and so she bought an individual policy to be covered. And the policy paid the small bills when they came in. But then she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And the insurer, Blue Shield of California, said, you didn't answer all of these questions. And you made some clerical mistakes on your application. So we rescind your policy. We behave as if it never existed. We're not going to pay any of those bills. And she has, I think finally after several years she's gotten a settlement, but she is very, very ill.
Were they doing this in the 80s and 90s, or is this a recent development?
This is the pattern of claims departments doing this had depended on the Supreme Court and the federal appeals courts giving the claims department of insurance companies a very unique status. They have legally the same kind of status that, for example, the Social Security Administration has. The notion is that they can make impartial decisions about your claims, notwithstanding the fact that they have a clear conflict of interest because it's into their advantage to deny your claim and save themselves the money. And it was a series of Supreme Court decisions that basically gave the insurance companies these rights. And right now, to reverse a claim by an insurance company's claim department that denies you coverage, you have to prove not only that they were wrong to deny you, but that they denied you in an arbitrary and capricious manner, which is a terribly high legal standard to meet.
Do the insurance companies prefer this thing where the responsibility for getting health care coverage is shifted to individuals rather than being paid for by employers or, as in some cases, by the government?
I don't know. The individual market is such a mess in this country that it's hard to imagine that anybody would want to operate in it. But it is clear to me that the insurance companies do very much like this status that their claims departments have. And in fact, in the book, I tell the story of an insurer who worked very hard to be sure that cases were of the particular sort that allowed them to have this status and be protected in this way.
To some degree, doesn't this grow out of that whole sense of American personal responsibility and drive?
It absolutely does. I mean, and there is a great strain in America that I can do it on my own, frontier spirit can do. What I argue in the book is that there is also another strain in American society going back as far as the very founding of the country by Europeans, and that is towards a minimal sense of obligation to each other. And it seems to me that the pendulum has swung very, very far in the direction of on your own, do it yourself. And it is time that it begins to swing back. And the fact is, today, it's not going to swing on its own. It's going to get pushed back. It's going to get pushed back by the political process and by people demanding it.
Your critics, like Mark Levin, say you're propagating a Marxist proposition and more government intervention in the financial markets. So are you a closet Marxist?
I am not. I believe that America is...
Would you admit to it if you were?
I think that this country is an amazing place and that this economy is an amazing place and that we do change. We changed in the 1970s. We changed directions dramatically. There's no reason within the American system that we cannot make changes again to give people at least this minimal sense of security so that they can go about actual human lives.
Now, the question that a listener poses is, are these really common, or are these the atypical situations, all of the illustrations you give in this book?
Yeah, one of the things I try to do in the book and is to judge that. Now, I have to confess to you and to readers that the way I do this is I generate a set of statistics that try to look at the economy from out the front door rather than from top down. And what they show is that these sorts of things are happening to the majority of Americans. My confession to your listeners is that it is heavy slogging through chapter 3 where I give these statistics and make this case. But the point of making the case is to tell readers, look, I didn't just pull a bunch of anecdotes from the air. This is a trend that runs across the board of most of the income spectrum.
Peter Goslin is a 2-time winner of the George Polk Award. He's written a book called High Wire based on a series of articles that he wrote over the last several years for the Los Angeles Times, where he is the national economics correspondent and a member of the party's Washington Bureau.
Not the parties.
The papers. Oops, back to that Marxism. Are you also still visiting fellow at the Urban Institute? Because often those things are on the book jackets, and then it turns out that ended two weeks ago.
I'm still there.
High Wire is published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.